This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballow. Today on the show, we're marking Veterans Day with a look back at the history of soldiers returning home.
You know, talking about soldiers returning home, I recently had a very interesting experience with my predecessor as president, the University of Richmond here, 82 years old, Bruce Heilman, just returned from riding across the entire United States on his Harley Davidson. And what he was doing was retracing the path that he had followed at the end of World War II, when as a very young veteran of the Marines who had fought in Okinawa, hitchhiked from California to Quantico. He titled his brand new autobiography, An Interruption That Lasted a Lifetime. And the interruption was his 4 years in the Navy, which he joined when he was 17 years old.
Yeah.
And so now as he's sort of thinking about, you know, okay, what else do I want to do in my life? Riding across country and connecting with his old comrades is the main thing that he's doing.
You know, it's true. We think about vets and we think about the war ended, they come back, they're adjusted, but we forget the way the military, that, as you point out, Ed, that short experience in the military can sometimes just shape an entire lifetime. It becomes almost the organizing principle or the narrative of one's life. This image, I've never met this man, but of him riding back against his trip east.
I would add that wars are the stuff of national identity,
yes,
and national mythology too. So it's not as if we have veterans who cherish their unique memories. Of course they do. They are incorporated into a broader understanding. And one of the problems with so-called bad or unpopular wars is they don't fit neatly into a triumphal, forward-looking, progressive national mythology.
Which is why we literally have a black gash as our formal official public memory of the Vietnam War. The memorial is often referred to as a black gash. And if you juxtapose that to your point about the making of a national story, wars we lose are wounds. They're black gashes in a national story.
That is a profound point, Brian.
It strikes me that historians spend too much of our time talking about the causes of wars and not enough time talking about the consequences of wars. You know, I have this little canned speech that I give against the concept of antebellum because I said, actually, it's always antebellum. We just don't know when the war is coming, right? But we cannot organize our lives around a war that we do not know is coming. And so I sort of said, get over this concept of antebellum America. On the other hand, postbellum America or postbellum Americas actually makes a lot more sense. And so I think that one way you could understand American history is a series of wars followed by unfolding consequences of those wars back home.
So today's show is our Veterans Day show. But before there was Veterans Day, there was Memorial Day. Here's an excerpt from one of the more famous Memorial Day speeches delivered in the 1880s by a prominent Bostonian, a man who had fought for the Union in the Civil War.
We attribute no special merit to a man for having served when all were serving. We also know very well that we cannot live in associations with the past alone. And we admit that if we would be worthy of the past, we must find new fields for action or thought and make for ourselves new careers. But nevertheless, the generation that carried on the war has been set apart by its experience. Through our great good fortune, in our youth, our hearts were touched with fire. It was given us to learn at the outset that life is a profound and passionate thing. Oliver Wendell Holmes, May 30, 1884.
In our youth, our hearts were touched with fire. It's one of the most famous lines in American Civil War memory. Now, Holmes spoke for a generation of men on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line, but his lofty language belied the war's darker effects. Matter of fact, you might not know from that quote that he himself was desperately wounded in the war. The years after the war ended, hundreds of thousands of men struggled to rebuild their lives, and they had no official government services to assist them, no language to describe the terror and isolation that they continued to feel. Psychotherapy hadn't been invented yet, so a lot of soldiers just turned to alcohol or rootless wandering. Recently, I had a chance to talk about some of this with Edward Tick, a psychotherapist who has spent almost 3 decades working with traumatized veterans of many American wars. He explained that, ironically, given Oliver Wendell Holmes's quote about hearts being touched by fire, in the decades after the Civil War, another metaphor of heart was used to explain what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. It was called soldier's heart.
The dominant medical model of the time put our afflictions in our heart rather than put it in the brain and central nervous system. So physicians of the 19th century believed that there were literal physical changes to the heart and how it functions as a result of exposure to war. They believed the heart enlarged, the heart beat harder. They also had the poetic meaning that soldier's heart was referring to the deep changes in how we feel, what we value, how we think, how we behave that result from experiencing war.
Then how did that concept evolve over the 20th century up to our time?
There are some fairly famous terms that the public is aware of. In World War I, we know of shell shock. In World War II, battle fatigue. Post-World War II, for a while, it was called combat neurosis, though that term was thrown out in the 1950s. And then there was nothing for a while between the 50s and 1980 when post-traumatic stress disorder was introduced. Vietnam veterans and other survivors of trauma had to lobby for years and years to even get the public and the health professions to admit there was a problem.
So how did we come to PTSD? What is it that that conveys that the earlier names for this did not?
Well, let me say that many veterans hate the diagnosis post-traumatic stress disorder because to them it sounds too scientific and medicalized and pathologized. Veterans returning from combat do want public and professional help and understanding, but they don't want to be treated as if they are individuals with an illness. So PTSD is diagnosed as a stress and anxiety disorder that can and will be developed by anyone who goes through severe, sustained, life-threatening stress. Normalizing it helps veterans realize that what they're carrying is an inevitable response to the horrors of warfare rather than any individual weakness.
So is it your sense that this is getting worse with technology and that Iraq is an especially kind of dislocating or terrifying experience?
Yes. Post-traumatic stress disorder is getting worse with modern American war conditions, and there are a lot of reasons. One is that the technology of destruction has become so brutal, moving at such lightning speed that it has surpassed the human capacity to tolerate and endure without breakdown. Then the nature of warfare itself changing from large, massive battles where armies range against each other, struggle for a few hours or a few days, and then break off and have days, weeks, or even months to regroup, to talk about what happened, to try to heal some wounds, and to reposition themselves for their next battle. That used to characterize warfare up through World War II, but these kinds of wars like Vietnam and Iraq, Afghanistan, are very different kinds of wars where guerrilla fighting, urban street war, not knowing who the enemy is, not being able to differentiate enemy combatants from civilians, and civilians and the infrastructure becoming recognized and acceptable targets, all contribute to massive confusion, pain, dislocation on the part of anybody serving. And all of these factors contribute to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, we have a few clips here that illustrate the feelings of dislocation that soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are facing. These were gathered by Youth Radio out in Oakland, California. Let's listen to them.
In a combat zone, you're going 100 miles an hour, you know? You're like a little radar, you know, turning everywhere. Coming from a combat environment to a civilized environment, that's really hard.
That transition from always knowing you'll have 3 hots and a cot and there'll always be someone right there to tell you what the hell to do if you're not so sure yourself, to being a functioning young adult, the pressure's huge.
You know, if you'd give me the choice, I'd rather be deployed than not be deployed.
You know, in Iraq, I knew where I was. I knew what I was doing. In Afghanistan, I knew where I was. I knew what I was doing.
I wish I would have stayed in the military because when I was with my unit, it was sort of a bubble. Nothing, what is it called? The outside world doesn't not get in. The thing, the hard part is when you go home and there's no 10, 20 guys you talk to in the morning and, you know, in PT formation. And that's the difficult part. When you wake up in your own bed and you don't have all those people you talk to every day.
I know when I go back home on leave and I'm with people that I knew before who don't really know me now, I tell them a story that's amusing because it's not that they don't really want to know the rest of it. They care. It's just that I don't know how to tell them. There's a huge portion of your life that they're never going to understand.
That was Jesus Bocanegra, Richard Denny, and Kevin Walter, veterans of the current war in Iraq. The interviews were conducted by Youth Radio, and we'll link to the full version on our website. So, Ed, if the incidence and severity of PTSD is increasing, would you say our means of dealing with it are increasing too?
I would say that's partly true. There's more attention to it. There's more publicity. On the other hand, the way we're practicing war, our politics, and many of our methodologies ignore some of the root causes of PTSD. One of the most troubling dimensions of post-traumatic stress disorder is what I call moral trauma. That is that people who have served in the military, people who have fought and perhaps killed in combat, are very troubled by what they did and why they did it and whether it was necessary. One World War II bombardier, he was in the Flying Fortresses over Europe during World War II, was a 19-year-old. And he came in for therapy in his late 70s because he said, I have felt like a mass murderer my entire life. I know World War II is called a good war, but I dropped bombs on civilian targets all over Europe. And I know I helped burn European cities and kill thousands and thousands of civilians. So I don't want to die torn to shreds by this legacy. I want to be able to go to the other side, face God, whatever happens next, with a clean conscience. And I don't know if I can do that. So please help me find some peace before I die. That's emblematic of what many vets feel. There is moral trauma in the core of the PTSD wound. Most health practitioners are taught not to talk about issues like morality, but leave that to the clergy. However, veterans are desperate to talk about that. And so we always have to help our veterans ask the moral questions too. Why did I serve? What was I serving for? And how was I used in the political climate of the times? And how do I feel about that now afterwards? And how can I give meaning to my experience and turn it from a moral wound into something that teaches me about human nature and guides me to live a good life afterwards?
Well, all that's wonderfully eloquent. I guess I would just end our interview by pointing out that all those are historical questions as well. If you don't understand where we were in that moment and why these things happened and why the leaders said the things that they did and, you know, how what you did fit into a larger pattern, it seems to be impossible for people to answer those larger moral questions.
Well, the historical questions are very important. However, some veterans achieve healing by identifying with the worldwide warrior tradition rather than with the particular service they had. So I've had veterans declaring as they're going through their healing process, I am no longer a Vietnam veteran or a Somalia veteran or a Korean veteran. Rather, I declare myself to be a warrior whose historical service was in Vietnam or Somalia or in Korea.
Kind of dehistoricizing it in a way, right?
Yes.
To taking right. solace in the universality rather than the particularity of their experience.
Exactly.
Ed, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And thank you again for giving airtime to this very important topic.
Dr. Edward Tick is a psychotherapist specializing in veterans issues. He's the founder of Soldier's Heart, a veterans healing center based in Troy, New York.
Well, Ed, to rehistoricize things, I just want to put three interesting issues of historical context on the table. One is literally how veterans are reintegrated into society? Does it really make a difference that folks returning from World War II come back on ships? They've got weeks, sometimes even months, before they get back to their home communities, as opposed to getting on a plane and, you know, a day later, they're home, boom. The second is the shift from a draft and a war effort where there's a sense of everybody being involved to an all-volunteer army, which in many ways further kind of isolates our fighting men and women, maybe makes reintegration more tough. The third cuts the other way. We now have folks, you know, before they engage in combat, they're text messaging and they're on the World Wide Web, sitting over there in Afghanistan and Iraq. And these are all issues of historical context that dictate how veterans are going to feel when they return, how they feel when they're away and serving away from society.
I thought it was really interesting, this notion of a worldwide universal warrior cult, because, of course, that is a defining yourself apart from the larger population. That's
right.
Really part of the mythos and ethos of the modern military.
Now, I think that these are all great questions, of course. It strikes me intrinsic to the military experience, the fighting experience, is that you are simultaneously embodying what your society is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And forever alienating yourself
right.
from most of the experience of other people in that society.
And what strikes me about all of these questions and issues is how little control the veteran himself or herself
right.
actually have over any of these.
You know, and that's the spirit, I think, of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, as we heard at the very beginning of today's show. They're saying, look, cut the individual foot soldier some slack.
Yeah.
You know, whatever you think they were doing, they were just doing what seemed right at the time. So if we took it from the experiential frame of reference mm-hmm, rather than mm-hmm. the political frame of reference, you can see the logic that they try to follow on that.
Well, guys, I think that's a good note to end the show on. Listeners, the conversation continues online. Visit us at backstoryradio.org to see what people are saying. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show.
And while you're there, sign up for our free podcast and our weekly newsletter. That's at backstoryradio.org. Thanks for listening.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore. Jamal Milner mixed the show.
Lydia Wilson provides administrative support. Gabby Alter wrote our theme. And special thanks today to Miles Creasy and the good folks at Youth Radio. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Winter. Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, and Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation.
And by Caroline Feeney, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, J.M. Weinberg, Trish and David Crow, Claire Gargalli and David Carley, and an anonymous donor.
Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.